Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, Blog Talk family. This is Leslie Gist. We're listening to the Gist of Freedom, and we have tonight's guest on the line, Mr. Herb Boyd. Are you on the line?
I'm here.
Great. Mr. Boyd, could you introduce yourself to our audience?
Well, you can say that I wear about four or five koofies. One is an author. One is a journalist. One is an activist. One is a teacher. One is a grandfather.
Wow, grandfather. Okay, let's start with the grandfather role. Let's go back to your childhood.
Well, you know, I was born in Alabama back in 1938, and I spent only about 4 years there and moved north with my mother, my brother, and was raised in Detroit. And I've been living here in New York for the third time since 1985. Before that, I lived here about a year and a half, 1960 to 1961 and a half. And I came back again in 1978 for about 6 months. But this time, you know, 1985, the third time, as they say, Leslie is charmed. And I've been here all along, and ostensibly I came here to kind of jumpstart my writing career. You know, if you're going to be the writer, you got to come to New York, because that's where all the publishers and editors and what have you are. So I've been very, very fortunate, very blessed over the last 25, 26 years now to have a number of books out there and to achieve a certain amount of recognition and acclaim in the literary world, which, of course, is always my dream and always my aim. So my dream came true.
Wow. Now, we can understand why your grandson will become an activist and educator. But who influenced you to become the activist and the educator?
Well, I think, first of all of the, most of what I am is mostly due to my mother and I guess a succession of other women in my life, including the mothers of my children, as well as my current wife. They've always been very loyal and devoted and have helped me as I grew and developed, you know, in any one of those enterprises out there. I couldn't have done it without them. And I continue to have a team around me that have helped me to kind of keep my eye on the prize. And also to deal with those early influences in my life and to live up to their accomplishments and achievements, because my first literary idol, I guess, was James Baldwin. And even when I was a teenager, I used to keep his books in my back pocket.
Now, you mentioned being born in the 30s.
Sure.
For our younger listeners, could you tell us the difference as far as socially? What was going on and what was more important as to African Americans at that time when you were a teenager, let's say?
Well, okay, I came of age during the Civil Rights Movement. A real consciousness occurred when Dr. King and Rosa Parks and all of those gallant heroes and sheroes of the Civil Rights Movement began to rock this nation. So I was like 14 or 15, I think, when Emmett Till was killed down in Mississippi. When the Montgomery Improvement Association came into existence, when Dr. King became a person of real nobility, when the Black Panther Party, when Malcolm X, and when I was about 20, 21, and I hooked up with Malcolm X and the Nation of Islam, and then on to the military, and out of the military I was going to come back and go to New York. I was living in Detroit back in those days, and so my aim was to get to New York and be a part of Malcolm X's new organization after he left the Nation of Islam. Of course, when
he
left.
How did you learn about Malcolm X?
That's how I learned mostly about it through a very good friend and my cousin who were members of the Nation. And I used to come by the house, and they'd bring all their newspapers with them because they had to go out and sell these newspapers. And I'd never seen the newspaper before, so it was like Muhammad Speaks. And I just became like a very, very passionate reader of the publication. Then I would go out with them, and then they start taking me to the mosque with them. And I would go to the mosque, and they start talking about, you know, this guy, Malcolm X and everything. So I wanted to see him. So I ended up in the mosque and ended up, you know, in the Nation and everything for, and that was about 2 or 3 years I was there. Because then I went into the military, and then when I was in the military, Malcolm, 1963, when he made that comment about President Kennedy's assassination, about chickens coming home to roost, and which got him in hot water with the Nation and its Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and he ultimately led to his dismissal, or I should say how he was pushed out of the organization, and then ultimately started his own, the Organization of African American Unity and the Muslim Mosque Incorporated. So when I heard about all those things, I had just come out of the Army, and so I was in Detroit. And Malcolm came to Detroit right after his house was firebombed, which was absolutely amazing. I didn't think he would come once I heard his house had been firebombed. I just figured there wouldn't be no way in the world he was going to come to Detroit. So I went to work that day, and lo and behold, he came in, and my cousin told me, he said, man, you could smell the smoke on him, because all he had that he salvaged from his house being destroyed was what he had on his back.
Wow. Now, I want to get back to Malcolm, of course,
sure.
But how did James Baldwin relate to Malcolm, and what about James Baldwin and what you liked about James Baldwin?
I think more than anything,
was similar to Malcolm.
I think, well, they had Harlem in common, and I always dreamed about coming to Harlem, because even as a kid, when I was reading about the Harlem Renaissance and Langston Hughes and Zora Neale Hurston and all these fantastic Duke Ellington and Bessie Smith, it was just like the music and the theater.
Wait, you got to back up. Today, uh-huh. Children aren't reading about these people or the Harlem Renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
What school did you go to that brought the Harlem Renaissance to your classroom?
The classroom was brought in, I got it in the classroom through the various books that the teachers would use in social studies. And it would always have a little bit of, it was never much there. It was maybe
a segregated school?
Excuse
me? Was this a segregated school?
Oh, no, no.
Was it a black school?
I mean, it was open. The thing about it is, just given the nature of the community, there may be one or two white students there, but primarily the first schools I went to were all black.
Mm-hmm.
And the teachers were basically all white. And if there was any whites there, they were in an absolute minority.
So your white teachers turned you on to the Harlem Renaissance?
Oh, yeah. I had some very, very, they turned me on to just about everything in terms of the history and politics and literature of this country. I got it from them. I had some very good teachers. Amazingly, I can remember all of them, too, and exactly what they stressed and what I gained from them. But I was always very curious. I mean, I had a deep love, a passion for books, because my mother had instilled that in me right at home. So I had good home training before I got to school, because I was reading when I was 3. But my mother had taught me everything. So when I got to the kindergarten, you know, I whizzed right on through that. Next thing I know, I was in the 3rd grade. So
you had a library at home, I guess.
Oh, yeah, but see what happened? There used to be traveling salesmen in this country who would go around and knock on doors and sell the Britannic Encyclopedia and Grolier Encyclopedia. My mother brought me a set. The first set she brought me, I was 10 years old, she brought a set of encyclopedias. But even beyond encyclopedias, since she was a domestic servant, so she used to clean homes in the various rich homes in Detroit. And she would bring home a lot of the stuff that they considered of no use and no value, particularly magazines and clothes. I mean, she brought home all
so
kinds of
stuff. So she was still in some learning.
So she was bringing me all the stuff. And she never had more than an eighth grade education herself. But back then, I guess an eighth grade education, depending on where you went to school, would be equivalent to like a couple of years of college these days. But
right.
Anyway, she acquired all this information, and she brought it home to me. And that's where I got really excited about magazines, because I used to read all these different Collier and Saturday Evening Post and Look and Life and Reader's Digest. She brought all those magazines home. But a lot of the kids in my neighborhood, they had never seen those things. So I had,
right.
I had a leg up on them in so many ways in terms of being worldly. And, I mean, Ebony Magazine. Later on, of course, I got into the black publications, too.
Now, let's change the subject just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned she was a domestic servant.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me, what is your take on a movie, The Help or the book, if you even saw the movie?
Well, I've heard so much about both the book and the film. Of course, I didn't read the book yet, and I haven't seen the film.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, it's just some reason that just finding the time to get into some things that I heard so much about, and it didn't excite me. I found nothing at all exciting about that, because it sounded like, taking us back to the Jim Crow era and without any real, clout and significance. It may have been good character development, but in terms of the politics of the period, I'm always curious about those films and those books. Recently, of course, Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, has excited me. Isabel Wilkerson's book, The Warmth of Other Suns. Douglas Blackman's Slavery by Another Name. Those are the kind of books I'd love to see films made of.
And didn't they do Slavery by the Other Name on PBS?
They had the documentary on the other day. I didn't see all of it, but I do have a copy of it now that a friend gave me just the other night at an event. I walked up and made sure, because I had told him because I blurbed the book when Douglas sent me the original manuscript and asked me to write a blurb for him. And if you get the hard copy version, you can see that I have the final blurb there, which I talked about how important that book was, because, first of all, it was coming out of Alabama. And anything to do with Alabama, since I was born there, I always have an interest in it. I have a good collection of books on Alabama in my house. So when he sent it to me, I said, oh, wow, this is something they don't talk too much about in terms of the continuation of slavery right into the 20th century, in effect. So that excited me, and I saw parts of the documentary already, but now I have a complete DVD copy of it, so I'll look at it later on.
Great. Now, you've written a bunch of books.
Yeah, that's a good way to put
let's
it.
Let's talk about, and let's also, before we delve into the meat
sure.
of our conversation, let's just give everyone your contact information and where they can learn more about you and your books.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just, how would someone reach you if they wanted to purchase
your
book?
Well, the best thing to do is to go on, they can go, we live in this digital universe. And back in the old days, it would be a challenge. You have to go to the library or make all kind of phone calls, to find out anything. But now you can just get to a computer, or you got a smartphone or something, an iPad, iPod, or iPhone, or iPod. You got any one of those things, you have immediate access to information. And just go ahead and go get online and just Google me, and you can, and they can see everything. I mean, all of the books and some of the magazines I write for, and some of the newspapers I write for, and some of the radio shows I appear on, some of the television stuff, all of that stuff is instantaneous. You get it right away.
Right.
And,
now, I met you at mm-hmm. a wonderful event. Do you want to explain the event?
Okay, what
Freedom
event?
Sisters?
What are you talking about? Huh?
The Freedom Sisters exhibit.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's and it continues. In fact, I was at an event yesterday at the Left Forum at Pace University, where each year they have a gathering of all the radicals and militants and people on the left, activists. And so I had a panel there on dealing with Malcolm X. And the whole Occupy theme, the Occupy movement is all over the place. So they had the theme this year was the Occupy theme. So I had a panel called Occupy Malcolm X. And I was selling the book there, and some people came by representing the Freedom Sisters and left a whole bundle, a whole package of their brochures. And so I just slipped them inside the book. So whoever bought the book would get a copy of the brochure of Freedom Sisters, which, of course, I think is a very important exhibit because, particularly during this month, which is, you know, Women's History Month, and they have like 20 to 25, no, it's a good number of African-American women icons, and I particularly like the one there for Rosa Parks, where you can go in and kind of interactive aspect to it. And, of course, you've got the Betty Shabazz. It's right there in the Malcolm X and Dr. Betty Shabazz Foundation Memorial Center, Educational Center, which, of course, is the old Audubon Ballroom where Malcolm was assassinated on February 21st, 1965. So that was quite an event. To see Sonia Sanchez, who Sonia was a very fine poet, was supposed to be with me yesterday, but she was a little bit under the weather and exhausted, so I told her she shouldn't try to make it from. She lives in Philadelphia. I told her not to try to make it to the event, but she made it to the Freedom Sisters event, and it was so good to see her there along with, I think, Merle Williams. I saw Merle for a few minutes, and Merle and I reminisced about Manning Mirabal because Manning, of course, worked with her on her book. So it was good to see her, and we chatted a bit about the past, you know, with her husband, of course, was Megger Evers. And then I think it was some of the Shabazz sisters came in later on. So it was a very interesting event, and I think it continues there. I mean, the exhibit is still alive.
Through April, through the end of April, I know.
Oh, yeah,
April 22nd. Now, let's talk about the book you were selling. Give the audience the title of the book.
It's called By Any Means Necessary, Malcolm X Real, Not Reinvented, and Critical Conversations on Dr. Manning Mirabal's biography of Malcolm X. And what we did, I mean, the title alone suggests exactly where we're coming from. There was somewhat concern about Dr. Manning's interpretation of Malcolm X's life. Not so much me, but because I'm just one of four editors, Dr. Maulana Karenga, Dr. Hakeem Adhubuti, and Dr. Ron Daniels, joined me as the editors of the book. We have 35 different reviews and essays and other commentary about that book that we accumulated over a nine-month period. So the book came out in 9 months, which was, you know, books usually take a couple years to get out there, but we turned this one around quite rapidly, given the kind of rancor and debate, discussion, controversy that's going on with Manning Mirabal's book. Manning was a very good friend of mine, and for many, many years, and, you know, I have just an enduring respect for him. But at the same time, you know, he would recognize and appreciate, I think, to a certain degree, the kind of reaction he stirred here. It's just unfortunate that he's not here to deal with it. He can't realize any of the rewards or fruits of his labor. At the same time, he's not here to defend, you know, some of the controversy that he has invoked. So what we've done is that we brought these different reviews together, and it's one of the things about all of this is that it continues the debate and discussion about a very important American hero, and that is Malcolm X.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. I thought we lost you for a minute.
Sure.
Right. So, you named four people, four of you that got together.
Yeah, the four of us. You know, and you're talking about people who, with the Maulana Karenga, you must know of his work in terms of Kwanzaa. He was one of the creators. He's created a whole celebration of Kwanzaa. And Dr. Ron Daniels, who has been in the movement, particularly doing the whole Black Independent Political Party, the Political Assembly, back in 1972 at Gary and Gary, Indiana. That was his brainchild. He heads up the Institute of Black World 21st Century right now. And he's been like our ambassador to Haiti. And he's taken me to Haiti with him on several occasions. And we put together a couple of documentaries on Haiti, particularly right after the earthquake last year. Then you have, I should say 2 years ago, and then you have the situation with Hakeem Adhubuti, who's an outstanding poet and essayist and author, and he's the Third World Press. And, of course, they're responsible for publishing the book. So it was. We put our heads together on this situation.
Now how did this start? Someone called someone? Did you Facebook each other? Did you tweet? How did this collaboration begin?
Well, it started with, it kind of grows out of it's contextualized in the sense that if you go back to 1968, William Styron came out with a book called The Confessions of Nat Turner. And it aroused the black intellectual activist community. And Dr. John Henry Clark, who was my mentor, he's no longer with us. He died in 1998. But he was the editor of a book that came out called 10 Black Writers Respond to Styron's Confessions of Nat Turner. And I had that in mind when I began to pull the team together. Because we had tried to do a similar thing in 2010, around Skip Gates. Dr. Henry Louis Gates came out with an op-ed piece in the New York Times called Ending the Slave Blame Game, but he wanted to attribute 90% the kind of facilitation of the slaves moving on the transatlantic slave trade. He kind of dropped the blame on the African chiefs. I mean, 90% of them were complicit.
Oh, I didn't know he was the one that began it.
He did that.
That was clear.
Yes.
Okay.
So that aroused us, and so some of the same people who were involved in the current project we did a teleconferencing. We called, and at some point we had 15 of us on the line doing these teleconference phone calls and everything. So we said we should come out with our own book and deal with him and kind of set the record straight. That's what we were going to call it. And so we had a couple of forums. But the book never materialized because you were commissioning people to do it. And, of course, these scholars and activists and academics, they're very busy, so they couldn't take any time out of their schedules to do it. So that was one of the problems we had. But here, with these reviews, it's a different thing because they're all out there, and all you need beyond just being, as Richard Wright said, if you want to be an anthologist and editor, all you need is a pot of glue and a pair of scissors. And go to work. This day and age, all you need is a good computer, and you can accumulate all the stuff you want that's been published out there. So it's about 100 reviews of Fannie Mirabal's book. So we just wanted to get a good slice of them. We could have added more, but the book would have been thicker, and there'd just been more piling, more dumping on Manning. So we say, hey, we got a good consensus, a good representative slice of those reviews out there. And we need to hurry up the process. So we took those 35, and they represent a wide range of thinkers in our society. A good third of them support Manning. Two-thirds of them don't. And therein lies the rub in terms of the title of the book. It's skewed toward support and defense of Malcolm X.
Wonderful. Mm-hmm. Now, what does the family, his children, his survivors, think of your book?
With them yesterday. I was with Ilyasa and Malek, two of the daughters, came to the conference yesterday. And, Ilyasa, she has the last word in our book. She wrote the last essay in the book about the Manning Mirabal's project. So we felt it was only fitting and proper that she get the last word. And but she was a part of that essay that she presented. It's not so much a response to Manning Mirabal, but more or less, how she felt about her father's legacy, his legend, and his life. And it was something she delivered at the panel that we had at a church, a year before. So we asked permission to use that, and she said, well, by any means, go ahead and use it. And so when I saw her yesterday at the conference, she told me she had a chance to look the book over, and she was very proud of it. But she's not. The sisters don't feel that good about Manning Mirabal's book because, I mean, you can't do a book like that without having consultation with the daughters and with living relatives. And I think they were turned off when they heard about the proposal and what his intentions. And so that was enough to say they didn't want to participate in the project whatsoever.
You said he died very shortly before the book.
3 days before. Mm-hmm. April the 1st, he passed, and then the book came out 3 days later. And it was like highly promoted. I mean, reviews all over the place. Amazing.
Just like Henry Louis Gates is highly promoted.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Why do you think, you know, you spoke to me earlier this morning about this, but why do you think these people who have such great, you know, credibility and did such great work would all of a sudden do something so far removed from their other work?
Well, I think, you know, you have to understand exactly, and it's hard to do a psychoanalytical thing on this because they'll be practicing, you know, psychiatry or psychology without a license, but
right.
You know, try to get into his head and where he was coming from. But I guess he felt that he was providing a service for us. And there's a large number of people who agree with that he has provided a very valuable service in terms of looking at Malcolm's life, you know, despite the failures in there. And some of our people in the contributors to the book, you know, they point out the fact that it's some very valuable things in there. I mean, we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. There's a certain amount of very, very interesting and new information that he's pulled together. But at the same time, you have some stuff there, very disturbing material in there. And, of course, when you have that kind of stuff, people go straight to it. When you start talking about Malcolm being, you know, the homosexuality, the infidelities, and I think those are the things that turn.
But there's a pattern starting to emerge, not just with Malcolm, but even Martin Luther King.
Yeah, that's
you mentioned
the
play earlier this morning.
Exactly, the whole humanizing thing that some of them begin to rationalize, you know, these new perspectives. We're going to take another look at these individuals and warts and all, and at the same time, it's an opportunity for them to commercialize and commodify, you know, the kind of an icon. They kind of de-iconize these individuals and kind of bring them down a notch and to humanize them. Well, we accept that it's not St. Martin. It's not St. Malcolm. We never wanted to deify these individuals. We didn't see them as gods. We saw them as human beings who made the ultimate commitment in terms of the struggle and liberation of their people. Nothing more than that. We realize that they got up in the morning and they pulled the pants on and they brushed their teeth and combed their hair just like everyone else. But at the same time, they went out there on the ramparts. They made the ultimate sacrifice. You know, they were absolutely committed and devoted to the struggle of their people. And so that set them apart from the kind of ordinary quotient kind of thing that you recognize in our communities. So, I mean, for that alone, they deserve all the heavy adoration and idolization we can give them.
And do you think that it is that his purpose, which was to, you know, to defile his memory, you think it's going to backfire and now more people will embrace books like your book and movies mm-hmm. which show the true Malcolm, not the reinvented Malcolm?
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things about all of this here, and I think Amiri Baraka said it very well, is that it kind of renews and revives the whole discussion around this very, this magnificent, important individual as we struggle for the truth and clarity, because we're still not there. It's still so much more to be done, still so much more work we have to do. It's so much more to kind of dig into the research and the materials that exist out there. So all we've done is added another step on the ladder. But we still got a long way to climb before we get to a full understanding and how the majesty of Dr. King and Malcolm's life and a number of our other heroes and sheroes out of the human and civil rights struggle. We still got so much to do on that, certainly in terms of films. I mean, I look at some of the films coming out. I mean, where's the film on Marcus Garvey? Where's the film on Paul Robeson? Where's the film on Toussaint Louverture? Where's the film on Nat Turner and Gabriel Prosser and Denmark Vesey? Where's the film on Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, Zora Neale Hurston? We need those kind of films out there other than you looking at something like The Help necessarily.
But what do you think about everyone, and when I say everyone, I'm speaking primarily about African Americans, supporting the Red Tail film because it was produced by a non-African American, and
yes.
He struggled. You know, what do you feel about that type of relationship and support versus what you just said?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, first of all, you know, we have the ultimate responsibility and obligation to create our own cultural artifacts, and produce our own films and plays, and publish our own books. You know, and when other folks do it, and we look at that situation, then you're going to, you know, kind of put that down or dismiss it and what have you. But sometimes you say the genie is out of the bottle. It's too late. It's already out there, and a lot of people go in and support that particular endeavor. And so when you have a Red Tails out there, which begins to look at some very neglected parts of our history and culture, and we have some heroes there, but it's not a complete, it's not a perfect film. There's a number of flaws. There's a number of things that could have been done better. The same thing we can say about Spike Lee's film on Malcolm X. You know, it needs, it's not the last word. It's all it is it adds to the discussion. It makes
now, what would you think Malcolm would have said about Spike, who was originally an independent filmmaker, soliciting help or money and support from Warner Brothers?
I think he would say that that's the name of the game. That's the nature of the business. You try to get your product through with as much integrity as you can, realizing that, you know, there's all kind of mischief and demons out there who can sidetrack and destroy and diminish what you're trying to do. But nonetheless, you kind of push ahead because, you know, where are you going to get the money from? Bill Cosby and Oprah Winfrey and the other mega buccaneers out there, they have to kind of own up to it. We have enough money in the community among our so-called the plutocrats we have, the mega buccaneers, the millionaires, the billionaires. We have in our own community, if they put their resources together, they can produce, you know, something that would be equivalent to a major film out there. I mean, we've done that before.
Name some of the filmmakers of the past.
In the past, we can start talking about just independent filmmakers like Oscar Micheaux.
Right.
You know, what he was doing alone.
What about Madam C.J. Walker's
theater? Madam C.J. Walker. You talk about the people who... We had right here in Harlem, for example, we talk about Philip Payton and Pigfoot Mary, who acquired all kind of property and real estate and wealth as a result of investing in their own community, investing in their own people. So at the same time, you know, we have so many outstanding writers and filmmakers, and we have so many outstanding artists and sculptors and painters who have just gone without any kind of recognition whatsoever. So we have a responsibility to kind of support and expand and explore, you know, our own community and our own culture. We haven't done that.
Now, I was always told that, you know, integration killed all of our independence and our self-sustaining communities.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at Madam C.J. Walker's movie theater, it was beautiful. It was state of the art.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what do you have to say when you hear people argue that, you know, we ran to the white theaters because ours was run down or it was a Chitlin circuit?
Well,
you know, and then when you look at pictures of Madam C.J. Walker's theater and other places that were beautiful, you know, what is the real reason why these institutions went by the wayside?
Well, I think you said it right from the beginning in terms of what happened with the whole integration. When we were forced into kind of the restricted covenants and not allowed to participate, you know, in the society at large, the kind of widespread discrimination, you know, it forced us to fall back on our own. We created our own in every instance, in terms of the church, the schools, terms of the businesses, all of those.
Do you really think it was a force, or do you think it was just a natural, innate quality that every race has, that you're going to have your own church, you're going to have your own school? Or do you think even if Jim Crow wasn't in place, that we would have just gravitated towards a white school?
No,
we would
I
not have created our own.
No. It's very clear right now what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I'm watching the March Madness, right?
Right.
And the whole basketball thing go down. What historically black college is even contending? Not one. Mm-hmm. Who are the major players on all these here major squads? Black players. So what happens is people are going to go where they can get the best they can. Believe me, it's only natural. You're going to go where you can get the best education. You're going to go where you can drive the biggest car and live in the biggest house. You want the best you can get out of life. And, of course, it was always on the hill. It wasn't in the valley. It was on the hill. So you had to
okay.
try to...
Okay, and the same thing with the flight of the African-Americans leaving the South, going to the city.
Yes,
that's
another...
great migration.
That's another indicator right there. But that was a push and pull thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was the pull of the possibilities in the North and the push of the kind of dangers you face in the South. Because, first of all, you know, you had the Ku Klux Klan. You had this out-and-out discriminatory system down there. You had the plantation experience. You had the farmland, the boll weevil that it turned everything around. It was just the possibilities were so limited there. I mean, my mother is a good example of that. And she was born and raised in the South, but she was determined that her kids were not going to be raised there, not under Jim Crow. And so that's when she took flight and went north, and like so many people in our family did at that time, you know, looking for a better life. Because when Henry Ford was saying you can get $5 a day at working in his factory, and we weren't getting $5 on a whole month, hoeing in a field, there was no real option there. I mean, boom.
What percentage of the people that took flight to the north do you think took flight because of the boll weevil?
I mean, it's like I said, it was a push and pull thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was some of the kind of social conditions in the South were not at all, it was not kind of best situation. They weren't comfortable in that situation.
Okay, all right. Mm-hmm. I got it. I'm going to ask you a question about, talked about the boll weevil. Oh, I lost my train of thought. Apologize. I know what it's going to take. George Washington Carver, I just read this. He was trying, during the boll weevil epidemic, he had come up with the peanut, of course.
Sure.
And he started teaching people how to cultivate their land and, you know, this bio sustainability that they're teaching us now. He was teaching it back then. And I just read within the last 2 weeks that the China started importing the peanuts to undermine his movement.
Mm-hmm.
So when I read that, I was always suspicious of the boll weevil, and I always felt that the boll weevil was the real cause of the migration. I think African Americans would have stayed on their land, many of them owned the land, if they could have sustained it and lived off of the land. And I think it was a conspiracy to get us off of that valuable land. Now, you know, everyone's running back down to the South.
Mm-hmm.
But we have no more air property because the land was intentionally devalued. What do you have to say about
that?
Well,
I think you enter a very, very complicated situation that you have to put in historical perspective.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of how people in the South related to the land.
Mm-hmm.
Because even today you recognize there's a flight of people going back South.
Right.
They're going back home. And because of the economic situation, because of the land question, because of the retirement, because of the situation here
high
in the North.
High taxes here.
Yeah, so they're going back. But at the same time, you know, one of the reasons is that a lot of the families sold their land. I mean, I was in South Carolina doing a research project back in 1973 with the Gullah people who lived in and around the islands, the sea islands there in Wadmalaw, St. James, St. John, Beaufort, and St. Helena, all through there, and watch how these major corporations and companies came in and cut down the trees and drained the swamps and created golf courses and country
eminent
clubs.
Domain, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or were they able to use eminent domain down there?
Well, what they could do is that it was just land that was laying fallow. And no one necessarily owned the land. I mean, it was like swamp land. Nobody want no swamp land. And they just went in because they had the wherewithal to go in and drain the swamps. And next thing you know, they could put together a whole community there. What we had small communities in certain one of these islands down there, and they had a mutual kind of survival scheme that was typically African.
Right.
But after a while, they started to lose that property, and then each generation, the whole telecommunication situation, they were no longer isolated. See, so long as you were isolated, you could retain certain kind of Africanisms. But once that broke down, the whole penetration of the outside culture began to minimize their survival or wanting to stay there anymore. The next generation didn't want to be tied to no swampland. They were ready to go. I mean, now I'm going to New York. I'm going to Philadelphia. I'm getting out of here. So when they left and the older people died off, the younger people up north didn't want to come back down, so the land either just disappeared from their families, or they sold it off to companies.
Well, you make me think of the song, the Nina Simone song, Baltimore, when you said that.
Mm-hmm. I watched that happen in South Carolina, where families showed me deeds that went in their family, go all the way back to the plantation period when they owned that property. That property belonged in the family. And suddenly, you know, one young lady I knew, she moved to New York City, and she said she had no plans to go back down south because she had enough of the south, and she was trying to get away from all them hillbillies and crackers and rednecks. She was ready to go. And she sold it, and she got that money and invested it in a brownstone here in Harlem.
Hmm.
So that's what
wow.
happens with a lot of from one generation to another. One generation has to deal with it. Next generation feel they don't have to deal with it, and so they get up. But now you have a return because it's another generation, and they've sick of the north now. They want to go back to the south. But it's not a huge, but it's substantial. It's a substantial return to the south that's going on all across the north among African-American families.
And why, again, one more time, why are they moving back
one of the
down
reasons
south.
Is they have run into a situation where the whole cost of living is much cheaper in the south than it is in the north. That they can have their own property. For example, I come out of Detroit. If I wanted to go back to Detroit, I could go back to Detroit and buy up a whole block for what I pay in a month of rent here in New York.
Wow.
It shows you how the economic situation in some of these cities is so desperate that, you know, you have the city is vacated. You know, I mean, the city's bankrupt.
Do you think African Americans are taking black flight?
Oh, yeah.
Do you think the encroachment of other ethnic groups?
Look here in Harlem, for example. We've lost 100,000 African Americans over the last decade.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, where they went, I'm not sure, but they're not here.
Do you think that the African Americans didn't feel like it was no longer a community?
Well, one of the things,
the encroachment,
you know,
of other races.
Well, displacement has also got to be configured into this equation. No doubt about it, the gentrification is occurring, where they're being priced out. They can no longer survive here because of the condominiums that are going up, and it prices them right out.
Is that a new form of the boll weevil?
Oh, yeah, that's what happens. I mean, but we have to, how do you deal with that? Well, we also, at the same time, you have a large number of fairly affluent African-Americans who are coming in. So because they recognize and they see the same possibilities, a lot of the young white couples who are coming into this community, that is, it's a pretty stable community. The property, the stock is in pretty good shape. Maybe it's still a seller's, it's still a kind of a seller's community here. Not a buyer's, it's mostly sellers, but it's changing so rapidly that we're trying to kind of do the same thing in terms of how we move out of where we are and get into one of those condominiums where it's a lot easier to live there, particularly when you get to be elderly senior citizens, you know, you need all the accommodations you can get.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So what is your expectations? What do you plan on doing? Do you plan on going back to,
No, I ain't going south.
You should get enough of that.
If I do, it's going to be to the Caribbean, all the way to the Caribbean or go down to South America. So, no, I have no intentions of leaving Harlem anytime soon. I'll probably be, this is my home now. I'm just fine. I'll move around in Harlem, but I would not leave out of Harlem. I'll be right here for the duration now. You know, I imagine I got another, maybe I could, if I can get another 15, 20 years in, I'd feel absolutely lucky, and I'd be the same age as my mother and my father.
Wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I enjoy talking to you.
Oh, it's always good, Leslie. Let's do it. Let's do part two soon. Here.
We have to because we didn't touch on nothing.
Oh yeah, we got so.
But
much
we've talked
to cover.
About a lot, and I think people when they listen to this interview, they're going to learn a lot about African Americans in general. But I thank you. We're going to have you on again.
Thank
and,
you.
And have a good night.
Okay. Thank you, Les.
All righty. Bye bye.